Republican Party anymore. This is Donald Trump's Republican Party. We are all watching. That's right, guys. That's the message. These guys better fight for Trump. Because if they're not, guess what? We're coming for you, and we're going to have a good time doing it.
We will stop the steal. We won this election, and we won it by a landslide. This was not a close election. We will not take it anymore, and that's what this is all about.
This is an unprecedented security breach in the Capitol.
So people had gotten through the doors of the chamber. Windows had been broken.
There is now a nationwide manhunt underway for every rioter breaching the Capitol building.
President Trump and his closest supporters fired up the crowd that conducted this month's bloody takeover of the Capitol of the United States, all based on that big lie that Mr. Trump was the winner of last November's election. The Capitol building is often called sacred to the ideal of representative democracy, and that conjunction of politics and religion is powerful stuff. We'll hear more about that in a few minutes. First, let's get some historical perspective from Tim Naftali. He is a presidential historian at New York University, and he is one-time director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Southern California. Welcome, as always.
Thank you, Warren.
This is described as the first attack and occupation of America's capital since 1814 during the so-called War of 1812. How important is that as a historical marker?
Well, extraordinarily important. We have been blessed until January 6th, an unbroken line of peaceful transitions in Washington, D.C. In 1860-61, there was a violent transition. The Confederacy seceded from the Union in response to the election of Abraham Lincoln, even before he was inaugurated. But in terms of what has happened in Washington, D.C. and to our capital, what happened January 6th was a unique and I hope never to be repeated event. Why does it matter? Well, it matters because it's a symbol of the culmination, I believe, of Trumpism. What we saw was a campaign after the election in November, a campaign by the president and his allies to find weakness that would allow for an overturning of the voice of the people. He sought weakness at the state level. He then sought weakness through the courts. He then hoped for weakness at the level of the Supreme Court. Failing in all those attempts, he then doubled down and tried to pressure the state of Georgia. We heard his call to Brad Raffensperger. Failing there, he put pressure on the vice president to find some new role, an extra constitutional role for the president of the Senate during the electoral count. He failed there. And his last source of hope was an army of his supporters that he had encouraged to come to Washington, D.C., and that he unleashed. This series of events is unprecedented and represents an erosion, at least in the Trump era, of the guardrails set up to ensure a peaceful transfer of power and therefore to ensure the execution of the will of the people as expressed in the November election. That's why this matters today and will matter forever in our history.
Tell us more about what you describe as the army of his supporters. He received between 71 and 74 million votes in the election, even though that wasn't enough to defeat by any means Joe Biden. But to what extent do you think they were politically motivated? To what extent did they have other kinds of motivations? Is it even possible to know at this point?
Your question is more important than anything I can add today. What I mean is that you are getting at the crux of the issue. I don't believe, but I'm not a sociologist, and no one has interviewed everybody who participated in the insurrection. I do not believe that all 74 plus million people who voted for Donald Trump were spiritually represented in the crowd on January 6th. But I know that the challenge for our democracy and our republic is to de-radicalize the Republican Party so that those people who believe it is a patriotic duty to overthrow a government, our government, that those people are ostracized, that they do not feel any longer part of the Republican community. Because if you normalize the behavior of January 6th, then I see this country descending into, at the very least, waves of domestic terrorism. Much worse, and it was bad enough in the 1990s, but much worse than what we saw in the 1990s. So I don't know how many of those people are professional agitators. I don't know how many of them were caught up in the day and now will calm down and recognize that they have other things to do and should not attempt to overthrow the Biden-Harris administration. We don't know these things, but what we do know is that this is one of those clarifying moments in American history. I believe that the reaction of our elected officials to the January 6th insurrection is a litmus test, and that Republicans, not just in Washington, but throughout this country, need to make clear to their supporters that it is unacceptable and indeed unconstitutional to behave as those people did and to believe, first of all, that the election was stolen from them, but to believe that if you disagree with our constitutional processes, that the answer is to use violence and disrupt the will of the people.
Again, Tim Naftali is a historian, presidential historian at New York University. Let's get another clarifying moment. David French is a senior editor at The Dispatch and a columnist for Time magazine. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have written at length that what happened at the Capitol was, at least in part, a Christian insurrection. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the context, the reality of what occurred, the speech that occurred there, the immediate preceding events that led up to the riot, what you see is a very, very strong strain of what you would call Christian nationalism present. First, there was just a lot of Christian symbolism. A wooden cross was erected outside of the Capitol. People were storming up the Capitol steps with signs that said Jesus saves. One of the people who breached, I believe, is the House Gallery, perhaps the Senate chamber, was carrying a Christian flag. One of my colleagues at the Dispatch, who was present at the scene reporting on it, told me that Christian music was blaring from loudspeakers during much of this time. And this riot happened just a couple of weeks after something called a Jericho March. And the Jericho March was a Christian nationalist rally emceed by a Christian, he would formerly categorize himself as some sort of public intellectual, but now he's more of a rabble rouser named Eric Metaxas. And this Jericho March was an explicitly Christian event designed to sort of motivate people to continue to contest the election results. And this rally that occurred before this riot was strongly urging, in many cases, urging very dramatic action to overturn the results of the election. And I put it like this in a piece that I wrote over the weekend. If you had had individuals storming the Capitol, carrying Islamic flags with Islamic slogans on them, playing Islamic music and shouting Allah Akbar, people would have no question how they would categorize this. They would say this was an act of Islamic motivated violence. What we had was, and not everybody, certainly, I mean, there were people who were there from a variety of religious backgrounds, but there was a significant number of people there who are engaged in an action of Christian nationalist-infused insurrection and motivated by the belief that Donald Trump has a special command or a special call from God on his life to save this country from the left. And that's a part of this, and it has to be confronted. It has to be, those of us who are Christians have to confront this, have to defeat this, this ideology, this mindset that is infecting parts of the evangelical church right now. And so what I did when I wrote about it this weekend was I just wanted to clearly state what happened and what we need to do.
When you say that in the Jericho March and in the assault on the Capitol that they were contesting the election, obviously there's no evidence that Trump won the election.
Right.
What do they say when you confront them with that idea?
This is something where the religious element of this is very important to understand. Some folks just flat out disbelieve anything you say about the law or about the facts, that they're fully bought into the various conspiracy theories, whether it's the Dominion machines or, you know, conspiracy theories about ballots. And in other words, they listen to and believe Sidney Powell. I mean, the same person who's now subject to more than $1 billion libel lawsuit from Dominion. So some of them just flat out believe the conspiracy theories. But here's where the religious element of it is very real. Some of them are acting under the assumption that this has been destined. They're following people who believe that dreams or visions have told them that the fraud occurred and that this is a steal, but that Donald Trump will triumph in the end. And so in that circumstance, what do you do to convince someone that the dream or vision that they're following is false? That's very, very, very difficult. And so at that point, you've reached a point where a person is beyond persuasion. It's not like you're going to get them in a room and sort of walk through the court evidence and that 60 plus courts have rejected all of these claims. They're operating under a religious view that Donald Trump has a divine, what they would call a divine anointing, and that the actions taken to deny him the office of the president are satanic. So I wrote an earlier piece a couple of weeks ago saying that this Christian nationalism could lead to violence. And I got emails calling me a satanic priest for writing that article. But that's where we are. And that's why what's happening here right now is a symptom of a larger dysfunction within parts of the church. And we have to use law enforcement in the short term to deal with the radical factions that have attacked the Capitol. But in the longer term, the church has a big problem with lies and conspiracy theories spreading like wildfire through parts of the church.
And you're speaking, as you indicated before, as a practicing Christian yourself.
Yes, I'm an evangelical. I attend an evangelical church and I live in Franklin, Tennessee. So I'm talking about what I'm seeing in my own community, not so much my church that I attend, but what I'm seeing in the broader community that I belong to.
And when you say that people are basing their behavior in part on dreams and visions, does that mean it doesn't all come from Donald Trump?
Correct. So what you have is sort of this unholy alliance between Donald Trump and a collection of really what I would call religious charlatans who are gaining a great deal of exposure and notoriety by validating Trump. Validating Trump is sort of God's anointed, as I've said. And so, yeah, you know, the issue that you have here is that there is a metastasizing problem within, again, parts of the church that have really seen him as a divine warrior for God in a way that I have not seen with any other president ever. And yes, I'm fully aware of the irony of this, given Trump's personal morality, but I have never seen in my life, and I'm 51, almost 52 years old, I have never seen in my life a level of devotion to a political figure as I see in parts of the church to Donald Trump. And that the roots of that level of devotion are what we need to deal with.
We've been talking with David French, and we'll continue to talk with David French, the senior editor of The Dispatch and also a columnist at Time Magazine. I want to go back to Tim Naftali, our presidential historian at New York University. How does that sound to you?
Well, first of all, I think it's powerful testimony from Mr. French, but you may recall, Warren, that I wrote a book about counterterrorism. I was a consultant to the 9/11 Commission, a historical consultant, and I wrote about our government's approach to counterterrorism. And I have been thinking a lot about the process of de-radicalization. And our approach, you know, the law enforcement and intelligence approach to de-radicalization among our among American Muslims has been very controversial. There is a literature and there is a tradition there. But some of what David just said reminds me of the approach that the British government and the American government and actually the Indonesian government have, the approach they've mounted in the last 15 years, working with mullahs, working with religious faith leaders in the Muslim community to identify the perversion of Islam. And it sounds to me that David is talking about a perversion of Christianity. We have never, I don't know the extent to which law enforcement and our intelligence community has thought in these terms, but if what David is describing is true, and he is more of an expert than I am, then we are facing a challenge that will require local level cooperation with faith leaders to try to persuade. It's not necessarily a criminal reaction, but to persuade, educate, and de-radicalize communities. It's a slow, painful, difficult process. We have a constitution that beautifully protects our privacy, so one shouldn't be thinking of this as some kind of dragnet intelligence operation. But it is an operation of community building and de-radicalization. And David is talking about something that those of us who've studied international terrorism have thought about with regard to Muslim communities that have tried to rid themselves of those who dishonor Islam by engaging in acts of violence. And it does require, I think, a reframing of the challenge to the extent that David is describing an important element of the army that assaulted our capital.
So, David French, back to you. Are there evangelical leaders who are available, do you think, for the kind of counseling and the efforts at de-radicalization that I think you both want to see happen as soon as possible?
Yes, there are. There are a number. And what I would say is I served in Iraq during the surge in 2007, 2008 as part of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And I have to say that what I have seen over the last several weeks of this Christian nationalist radicalization, I'm not going to say it's a one-to-one comparison with what the radicalization that I saw. Obviously not nearly as violent as what we were dealing with, but it had echoes. There's no question it had echoes. And what you find within the church right now is a dynamic where those who are standing up to Trumpism have for several years now faced a vicious counterattack, just vicious. You know, the right is very fond of labeling the left as intolerant and addicted to cancel culture. And there are cancel culture issues for sure. There is a liberalism that exists on the left, but you should see and experience the cancel culture that exists on the right when you try to oppose Donald Trump and the viciousness that is unleashed against even some of the more powerful voices and long trusted voices within evangelicalism. So I could list a number of folks who have tried to maintain the traditional evangelical commitment that was at least professed before Trump of character and politicians who have faced a relentless backlash. And this backlash is so severe that I will tell you this, in my own church, and this is true, in my own church, people will walk up to me and tell me that they agree with me in a whisper. Not everybody. Some people are very loud and saying, I agree with you, David, about Trump. But some people will walk up and say in a whisper that they agree with me. Why would people feel like that? Well, what happens right now, the dynamic in social media in particular, is if you put something out there that is opposed to Trump and you're an evangelical, the attack that you're going to receive, even from longtime friends, is immediate, often very personal, and often very, very angry. And people are not prepared for that. They're not prepared for that. And so what you have is a dynamic in which the Trumpism, the fanatical Trumpism that exists within the church, is radiating outward and being inflicted upon the rest of the culture, as we saw on January 6th. It's also radiating inward and being inflicted upon dissenters. And again, not all churches are as dysfunctional. Many of them are super healthy and good with good leadership, but this is a very real dynamic. I got a text message from a very good friend of mine who's a GOP, a Christian GOP official. And the text message said to me, people see Trump as an idol. They are idolizing him. And he was speaking within the church. And so there is an enormous amount of conflict within the church, an enormous effort to punish people who defy the move towards Trumpism, and then a wave of people radiating out from the church that is, inflicting things like the Jericho March on the American public and what we saw on January 6th.
The Vice President, Mike Pence, is an evangelical. He is, it seems to me, famously at the moment, caught in the middle in this whole context in which we are speaking. Do you think he gets the kind of pressure that you're suggesting when it is suggested that it is time for him? And he did, in fact, defy the president in a very important way by saying that he couldn't change the results of the election. But is he somebody who at this point has the capacity, has the power to speak out about this?
He has an ability to speak. I don't know what audience he will have amongst the dedicated Christian Trumpists, because the view isn't that Donald Trump is God's anointed until Mike Pence says otherwise. I mean, one of the things that we saw in the attack on the Capitol was in real time, people chanting, hang Mike Pence. That's how quickly, if you turn on Donald, again, this is not everybody. This isn't a majority, but that what has been produced by this idolization of Donald Trump is a sort of tip of the spear radical that Donald Trump cannot fail. He can only be failed. And so when Mike Pence does what the law and the Constitution requires, as he did on January 6th, he has failed Donald Trump. He is defying the Lord's anointed. And that this creates immediate backlash. So it does not matter what you have done in service to Trump before. It doesn't matter. All that matters is you are with him every single step of the way. And so what's vitally important, I think, in the church is to use a term from that we used in Iraq, was separate the insurgents from the population. In other words, right now, the level of radicalization amongst a strong core of Trump supporters, which has empowered the creation of this sort of Jericho March movement, but it was also radiating back within the church in an intimidating fashion. We have to find a way to isolate those individuals and give sort of the larger church body an opportunity to breathe and catch its breath and have sane and civil conversations about how we got where we are. But in the frenzy of the moment, there's an awful lot of people who are trying to say, for example, the social media clampdown, Amazon Web Services taking down Parlay, all of that is proof. All that's proof of the existential threat to the church and to the nation presented by the election of Joe Biden. And so we're in a very difficult, dark, and dangerous time right now.
David French with the Dispatch and Time Magazine. Back to Tim Naftali. Red State, the week after the what we refer to as the insurrection, an article that begins this way. This is the headline, Opinion, Enough exclamation point. There was no riot, insurrection, or storming. I think storming is a reference to what the QAnon people talk about. So this is hardly restricted to Christians, this refusal to believe what you see.
I witnessed a very small subsection of this behavior when I was director of the Nixon Library, where I encountered people who were in denial about Watergate, and many of whom were not really old enough to have, were not old enough to have followed the events of the 1970s very closely, but had grown up with the sense that there was a narrative that had come out from elites, bipartisan elites, after all, in this case, which they just rejected. And their rejection, some of their political identity was wrapped up with that rejection. And I remember while I was there, we released, this process had gone on for years, preceded me and ended just after I left the job. But we released some more of the Nixon tapes. And I remember one member of that community who happened to work as a volunteer at the library come up to me and say that there was talk among the other volunteers that I personally had somehow created some of this, particularly the anti-Semitic comments by Nixon, created it to undermine his leadership. I mean, he's long since dead, but he was their powerful symbol. And what I think, as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, I think this moment we're in is a litmus test. I share with David the sense that we're in a very dark moment in our history. What I would hope, and it looks like this will not happen, but what I would hope is that the only positive consequence of the outrageous, of the deadly attack on the Capitol was that this would break the fever for some members of Trump world, that they would respond to this and no longer be, if you will, part of the Mao would talk about the sort of the pond in which terrorists swim, and they need activists, violent activists need fellow travelers to protect them, to fund them, and that maybe what happened on January 6th would be so shocking to the conscience of enough Americans to stop the process of augmenting the Trump world. But when Red State issues the statement it just issued, it's clear that it's not having the effect on some of the influencers. And that is very troubling. What's really necessary in the days before the inauguration and the days after the inauguration is for influencers on the right to speak out about the difference between legitimate and illegitimate dissent, and to talk about the lies of Trump. And if not, I don't see Trumpism going away, and I anticipate more violence, more terrorism, assassinations, and the like, as these angry people strike out against an America they now consider illegitimate.
I should point out that the former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger made a very passionate and moving statement himself just a few days after the violence, not just rebuking Trump, but pointing out that he had grown up in Austria, not during the Second World War, but after that, in what he referred to as a failed democracy. And the broken glass on the Capitol, he said, reminded him of Kristallnacht. It was a very interesting statement. And I'd also refer to a book, infamous book called The Turner Diaries, which is a novel, a very dystopian kind of novel about an overtaking of the United States in a very bloody way. It was reportedly something that Timothy McVeigh had before he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma. Which it is alleged other people who were involved in the events, more recent events in Washington, also were reading. I'm interested, David French, if you're familiar with that and if you think that there's an overlap.
I think there's a small, like explicitly white nationalist element that connects with sort of that Turner Diaries history. But I think what you see with this new radical right is it's different. So the new alt-right, for example, would not link back to Turner Diaries. It is much more rooted in sort of pagan mythologies. It is a very bizarre. It's a very bizarre worldview. Not that the Turner Diaries isn't bizarre, but it's a very bizarre, often mystical, racialist and racist worldview. But the Christian radicalism is rooted in something very, very different. It's much more this fusion of a particular version of American history with a particular version of Christianity, combined with the belief that even Joe Biden, the person that the left wing of the Democratic Party did not want to be its nominee, that Joe Biden would destroy the country. It's a much more immediate idea that this vision of America that's fused with this vision of Christianity is going to be directly and immediately threatened by the Biden administration, and that he lost the election in what is rightfully Trump's, and therefore what is rightfully the nation's and what is rightfully the church's is being taken from it. So that sort of Oklahoma City strain of white nationalism, this Turner Diaries, insurrectionary writing, it's still there. It's still there. But what we're seeing now is something much broader and deeper.
Very quickly, you mentioned, Tim Naftali, that every leader of this kind has to have enablers. It's being said that it is absolutely necessary that there be accountability for what has taken place. And of course, there's an effort with regard to holding the president accountable. But how far do we need to go with that? And how effective will it be if there's an effort to hold accountable some of the 147 Republicans, for example, who were willing to overturn legitimately cast and counted ballots in a presidential election?
I think there are two answers to that. On the first is that if the impeachment power means anything, you have to respond and use it against a head of state who seeks to overturn the Constitution. And if you don't, you're not laying down the historical marker you should. The second is what to do about Republicans who, at the very least, abetted the climate, if not stirred it, that led to the insurrection. I think there are two approaches. One, of course, their local electors, their voters, have to deal with this. In terms of what Congress should do, this is where I really hope deeply that Democrats do not take the forefront, but work with the Republicans who certified the vote, to work with them to find a way to send a signal to Republicans, through Republicans, that what happened on January 6th was a threat to our democracy, to our constitutional institutions, and a disgrace. I really believe that the most powerful condemnation of a political party is by those in the party. In 1974, it was when Republicans repudiated Richard Nixon and called him corrupt, that what little political power he held disappeared. Now, some people continue to support him, and core 28%, but for the most part, he no longer represented a political threat to the American community. Donald, the American people need Republican influencers to stand up. And so repudiation of Trump, it will be most effective if done by Republicans, I believe.
One final question to you, David French. You mentioned that you don't want to see a sort of dragnet intelligence operation set up in order to expose people, whether they be Christian or others on the right. And yet it is said that there is no law against domestic terrorism that allows investigators to do that kind of thing, to try to put off what happened in Washington, as they might have been able to do in the case of foreign or international terrorism that would involve jihadists. You made that distinction yourself. Does there need to be more in the way of law with regard to this so that investigators can, in fact, try to intercept based on intelligence the kind of thing that we saw in Washington?
I think we have all the tools that we need. Nothing happened. Everything that occurred at the Capitol was already prohibited by criminal law. And we have very broad federal conspiracy statutes, especially statutes prohibiting conspiracies to violate civil rights. And overturning the results of a lawful election is a conspiracy to violate civil rights. So we have very broad conspiracy statutes. We have very broad federal tools available. They just haven't been turned on this movement. I mean, one of the things that's so disturbing about what occurred on the 6th was how thin the law enforcement presence was. I will never forget the images of this very thin blue line of Capitol Hill police being absolutely overwhelmed by the seething, raging mass of those Trumpist rioters. And so we had the tools. We had the tools. They were not deployed. And that is a thing that I think is going to need to be a subject of intense investigation. You know, the FBI was very good after Oklahoma City at going in and disrupting this, what was at that time an emerging right-wing militia movement. It did it very effectively. But it's, so far as I know, these tools have not been deployed. And hopefully they're being deployed because there is an enormous amount of online chatter about armed protests that will be occurring at state capitals around the country. There's enormous amount of online chatter about new protests leading up to and during the inaugural. And so deploy the tools. We have them. Deploy them. And I'm very interested. And I think all Americans should be intensely interested in figuring out why was the police presence so thin on that day and why was the emergency help so slow in coming. We need answers to those questions because we saw from other protests during the course of the summer and riots during the course of the summer that the ability to deploy overwhelming force existed. In fact, Trump used overwhelming force to clear a path to a church for him to wave a Bible in the air. There was a ton less force there to protect the Capitol in January 6th than there was in April to create, or in, was it in May or June, to create a path for Trump to wave a Bible at a church.
There has been a lot of dispute about who told who what in that context. The Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund, who's now left that office, told the Washington Post that he requested assistance, didn't get it. There's a lot of argument about it. I think that's for another podcast. In the meantime, we have heard an enormous amount of very, very helpful insight. Not all that hopeful about the future, but certainly designed, I think, to prepare us for what's to come. And I want to thank you both very much for doing it. David French, again, now with the Dispatch and Time, and Tim Naftali, presidential historian at New York University. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Warren.
Thanks so much for having us.
After I made those closing remarks, our guests had a conversation between themselves. It was extraordinary, as I think you will hear, because they have both given us permission to run it, even though they didn't know we were recording it at the time. Here it is.
Thank you, David. That was very powerful.
Oh, man. I'm so distressed about what's happening.
Speaking from a perspective that makes it very understandable how distressed you are.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you stories about people I know that I grew up with, hopelessly radicalized right now, just hopelessly.
How do you explain that?
You know, I wrote about it and I said, For years, people in the church have been told what I call the enabling lies.
Yeah.
And the enabling lies are the left wants to destroy America. Sort of this Flight 93 election, you know, Hillary Clinton would end America, Joe Biden would end America. The left hates you. They hate you. They want to destroy the church. Mm. You know, this sunk in and sunk in. And when you become convinced over time that your opposition is so malevolent that they'd want to destroy your home, house of worship, that they want to fundamentally destroy the country, then you're vulnerable to what I'd call the activating lie, which is they're stealing the election. Or at the very raw, ragged edge extreme, they're pedophiles who are trying to steal an election, you know, the QAnon stuff. And so I think that there has been this catastrophic rhetoric for years, and it has consequences. It has poisoned people's minds.
No question about it. But what about, I mean, your minister?
Yeah.
He or she, they, I mean, what are they doing? Clearly, I mean, I get the sense that this person is not enabling this activity. You wouldn't be a member of the church if it were. But what are they doing to try to stop this?
Yeah. Well, my pastor speaks out strongly against Christian nationalism. I mean, he's controversial in that way. I mean, he's like a warrior against this movement. But a lot of pastors are part of it. And the other thing is, even pastors who are not, here's what they will tell you. They say, I am in front of my parishioners 90 minutes or an hour a week. And Tucker Carlson has them and primetime Fox has them 15, 20 hours a week. And I can't compete. And and so I have a disproportionately pastor heavy audience. And I can't tell you how much despair I get from people who say, I don't have the people who have the hold on their hearts on this issue are Mark Levin or Tucker Carlson or Rush Limbaugh or worse, you know, some of the Newsmax or OAN voices. And so they feel outmatched. But the truth be told, there's pastors who are all in.
I have one more question for David. One of my hopes, again, it's not a hope, but I wondered whether COVID-19, which brought to the fore life and death issues.
Right.
And that it might wake up people to the consequences of following this Svengali. But clearly it didn't, because 74 million Americans voted for Trump. What am I missing here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that... And I thought the daily, I mean, I've been fighting this Trumpism stuff since he came down the escalator, but I thought the obvious incompetence of his response, including the daily press conferences, which were just painful to watch. But if you are convinced, and you, before all of this happened, that the other side is just an outright threat to your existence, you're going to find a way. You're going to find a way to justify the way the president acted. And he gave the blueprint early on, which is sort of the denial of its severity. And I would say that as maybe even more distressing than the embrace of Trump has been the cavalier attitude of a huge numbers of people in the Christian church towards public health. Not everybody, like our church has been very careful. We have complied with all applicable health regulations and gone beyond them. But you know, the cavalier way, this anger at masking, for example, from a pro-life movement, again, what this shows is it's an evidence of a very deep sickness. And then when you try to point it out, you're a traitor, because what instantly happens is they say, well, you're now, if you criticize us publicly, you're providing power and ammunition to the people who want to destroy us. So an internal critique and this sort of binary choice mentality says every internal critique is an ammunition for those who want to destroy us. And therefore, you're a traitor.
And, you know, and Trump knows this, because in his statement on January 6th, the video statement, he said, remember, those who oppose us are evil. He made it clear. I mean, he's played on this Manichaean worldview.
Yes,
for his own reason.
It's that binary choice, and And so what ends up happening is that I really can't emphasize that enough, because we have had, my family has had the most horrible experience with harassment and threats and everything for years now, is it you are a traitor. You are a traitor. And, you know, I can go to events now that are quote unquote conservative, and I can feel the seething rage towards me when I walk in the room. It's eerie. It's just this last week, somebody on the, I think on the alt-right, got my phone number, and all of a sudden my phone has been full of voicemails. I don't answer, you know, calls from numbers I don't know. Full of voicemails that are just the sounds of screaming. That's not nearly as bad as the kind of harassment I've had before then. And so that's the dynamic. And in that circumstance, I understand why people fall silent. You know, who wants to deal with that? Who wants to, but the bottom line is people have to stand up. So, for a long time, I've been saying this can get violent, this can get violent, this can get violent. And people have said, oh, you're clutching, it's pearl clutching. Well, where are we now? I mean, where are we now?
Sure. I'm so sorry for you and your family.
I appreciate that.
No, I mean, it's very, it makes me very sad. I'm sorry. I live in a different cultural bubble, and so I fortunately up to now have not, I get some hate mail, but it's very little, and I'm really sorry. I don't know what else I can say to you, but I mean it. There's a patriotism and a love of country that is clearly inherent in what you're doing, and I'm sorry.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do. It's but you know, the thing is, with every attack, you're just further, it further confirms the necessity that you can't let them win. You can't let them intimidate you into silence. And, but I totally understand. I mean, there was this, this new freshman congressman from Michigan who said one of the reasons why some of the members of the House, objected to the election is they were afraid for their families in if they didn't. And that's very real. That's very real.
But I wish they would go, it would be so powerful if they just said that.
I know. I'm with you.
I mean, they don't have to even, they can say, you know, just say that. And, you know, as I said, I think the most important voices now are Republican and conservative voices.
Yeah. I agree with you.
Really?
Well, I just want to add my voice to the statement that Tim Naftali made, that nobody should be treated the way you have been treated. And the idea that elected officials are excoriated that way and treated that way and fearful of their families is not, it's not going to encourage a lot of people to run for election. Let's put it that way.
No, that's so true. That is so true.
Once again, thank you both.
Thank you, Warren. Thank you, David.
Yes, thank you all. I really appreciate it.
Our To The Point producer is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetare. You can listen again to this episode anytime you want, and others are available too on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to reach us on Twitter, we're at @ToThePoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly at WarrenAlney1. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on our shows, visit our website, go to kcrw.com/shows, and scroll down to The Point. You'll find links and details for all of our programs in our show notes. Thanks a lot for being with us this time, and please join us again